The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. After two drubbings in the post-debate polls, Nick Clegg appeared to be not the man for the job if you want a popular defence of the European Union. But can such a case ever get a fair hearing in Britain today? Also this week, Sage No More. Was Vince Cable taken for a ride by City analysts in the bargain basement sale of Royal Mail? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, our economics editor Larry Elliott, and the editor-at-large of Reuters News, and the author of a new book on the European in-out question, Hugo Dixon. The results, when they came in, were overwhelming. 69% of respondents to The Guardian's post-debate poll thought that UKIP's Nigel Farage had cleaned up on the second debate in Europe against a hapless Nick Clegg. A minute later, the results were mirrored by a similar margin in a YouGov poll. It would appear, then, that if the strong public argument about Britain staying in the EU is to be made, Nick Clegg is not the voice to make it. Now, Hugo Dixon, you've just published a book described by Boris Johnson as having done a superb job of defending the indefensible, the membership of the European Union, that is. So where did Nick Clegg go wrong, do you think, having watched the debates?
I mean, I think he made a lot of mistakes, frankly. But just to give you two, which I think are really important, I don't think he hit Farage nearly hard enough in terms of actually what out would mean. Leaving the EU, there are no attractive options. Certainly if we're looking economically, there are no attractive options. I mean, Farage was able to run this Swiss example again, say we could be like Switzerland. Well, Switzerland does have a free trade agreement with the EU, but it doesn't cover financial services. Financial services are our most important industry, 10% of GDP. If we didn't have a passport for financial services, which is what we have at the moment, our financial services industry would be cut off from providing services to the rest of the EU. So he missed a big trick there.
Norway, is that a model?
Norway is also, I mean, Norway does have access to the single market, but it has to follow all the rules of the single market, and it doesn't get a vote on the single market. So if you're interested in sovereignty, actually, it's a retrograde step.
So you're not talking now about tariffs, you know, import duties. You're talking about what sort of thing?
Well,
sort of
regulation. Rules? I mean, if to provide financial services, if we stick just with financial services, you can't provide. They are a regulated industry. Quite rightly, they're a regulated industry, because otherwise they blow up, as we saw, you know, just a few years ago. So no country allows financial services to be offered in a completely unregulated fashion. The point is that if you want to provide services, financial services, inside the EU, you have to abide by EU financial regulations. And if you don't, if you're not in the EU or, like Norway, in the what's called the economic European Economic Area, you can't actually provide those services. You actually have to if you're a foreign bank, you can provide those services, but you actually have to locate inside the EU. That would mean that a large chunk of the city would have to relocate in Frankfurt, Paris, Milan, or whatever if we left the EU. And that would be bad for British prosperity. It would be bad for British jobs.
And so he didn't explain what out would really mean in gory enough detail, you're saying. Was there anything else you think he slipped up on?
Well, I think there were lots of things. But if I make one other thing that I think he slipped up on, is he didn't do the vision thing at all. The last question in the debate was, where do you want the EU to be in the next 10 years? And he just sort of waffled on.
He said it'd be like it was now, I think.
Basically. I think if you're going to make a modern case for staying in the EU, you have to say, A, it's better than all of the alternatives, but B, it's not great, and we can make it better. And he should have said, these are the five things that I want to see changed in the EU over the next 5 to 10 years, and this will make something that is you know, not bad, into something that is actually pretty good.
In the Westminster throwaway line, Polly, does it feel like Europe was the future once, though?
I think that when it comes to the vote, it looks to me as if it's very winnable. I think what you got in the instant reaction to the debate was Clegg can't win arguments. You know, he is a busted politician. He couldn't win the argument on AV. You know, you'd think it'd be easy to offer people a little more choice in their voting chances. But no, and he couldn't win this. He hasn't the heft to win it. So when people said Farage won it, it didn't necessarily mean 70% of people would vote to leave tomorrow. And I think that's an important distinction. I think when it comes down to the hard nuts and bolts of it, people will know in their hearts of hearts that we are better in. The question is always, who puts the case? If you had all three political parties, if we do have to have a referendum, let's hope to goodness we don't, saying better in, I think it's winnable.
What do you think, Larry? I mean, you've written a lot over the years about the dreadful sclerosis that's gripped much of Europe.
Yeah, I think two big things. One, I think a referendum could be won by the people who want to stay inside the European Union. I think there's a tendency for voters to show a willingness to change up until the moment when they actually have to vote, and then they go for the status quo. That's certainly what happened here in 1975, when most of the polls, right up until the last few months, showed Get Out campaign winning. But actually, by the time the vote was actually held, it was 2/3, 1/3 in favour of staying in. So I think that people, when it comes to it, may be more cautious about leaving Europe than these polls, snap polls, suggest. I think the other issue, though, is that in Britain, the love of the EU, such as it was very much an economic thing, that we joined the economic community as it was in the early 1970s, not because we had a political desire to join the rest of Europe in a big project, but because our own economy had been severely underperforming relative to the rest of Europe for most of the post-war period. So it was very much an economic issue. We joined because it seemed like the right thing to do economically. Now, in the last 10, 15 years, that equation has changed substantially. The European economy has severely underperformed. So without any real political love of the European Union, the economic case taken away, I think it becomes much more difficult to win the argument.
I don't think the economic case there has been taken away, Larry. I mean, I think 10 years
of actually the European Union not growing very much and very, very high levels of unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, has made people in the UK think, well, what on earth is this all about? Why should we be a part of this? I think that's the point. And then without the real economic imperative, that then a lot of the political antagonism starts to drift back into the argument.
Look, I accept that point, but I don't accept that there isn't an economic case for staying in. I think there's a strong economic case for staying in.
It's a harder sell, though, isn't it?
I'm not denying it's a harder sell, but so I think you've got to raise your game. I mean, half of our exports go to the rest of the EU. If we cut ourselves off, we're not going to completely cut ourselves, but if we diminish our access to that market, that's going to be bad for jobs, that's going to be bad for investment. I mean, Clegg did make one good point about that, which was yesterday that the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders came out with a survey. 92% of the UK auto industry does not want us to leave the EU. 80% of the city says that, more than 80% of the city, in response to a survey from the City UK, said that they don't want us to leave the EU, and more than 90% said they don't want us to leave the single market. And so, I mean, I accept it's a harder sell, but it's still an extraordinarily important market for us. And what's more, we have a chance to make it better. And I mean, I would say the two things in the economic sphere which we can do to make it a lot better. One is the single market. It's very important, but it's mainly a single market in manufactured goods, where the Germans are extremely strong. There's still scope to complete the single market in services, where Britain has an edge. That could be hugely beneficial for us. The other thing is more free trade deals. We don't
between
have
the EU and other people.
Yes, we don't have one with America. We don't have one with China. We don't have one with Japan. If you did those three, that would be hugely beneficial for prosperity. I don't deny that it would also have some problems because globalization isn't an unalloyed benefit, but it is basically good for prosperity.
Only if we level up the standards in America. The danger is that a trade deal between the EU and the US means that we lower our standards on the environment, on food safety, on working conditions. Will the Americans accept the much higher EU standards? One of the great reasons for being in Europe is a general raising of standards. And I fear that TTIP, the deal with America, might have the opposite effect.
Can we just move beyond the economics for a second? I mean, when Larry talked there about the 1975 referendum, when a large proportion of the people voting would have remembered the Second World War and what happens when Europe goes wrong, and who were very aware at that time that Britain was in the famous phrase, losing an empire but struggling to find a role, both of which did give some sort of a political reason for wanting to be in the European club. Is there any equivalent thing today, do you think?
I think that the argument is still there, but it's a harder sell. I think that what Putin has been doing in Ukraine has actually coincided with, in the opinion polls, the first opinion poll for ages that showed about a week ago that more people wanted to stay in the EU than quit. I think people realize that that's not to say that people want to go on lots of foreign adventures. I think that Farage made a very good counterattack on Clegg there. I think Clegg made a huge mistake backing Cameron in his attempt to get us to bomb Syria back last August. But that doesn't mean to say that we're actually going to be able to achieve more in foreign affairs if we're on our own. I think people realize that. We are 1% of the world's population, 3% of the world's economy. The idea that we can stand up to bullies in other countries, whether they're Putin or potentially, you know, the Chinese at some stage, or even in economic policy to stand up to the Americans on our own, I think is fiction.
Don't you think, Hugo, that to an extent there's been a bit of sort of imperial overreach by the EU? That there were two ways that the EU could have gone. One was to finish what it was doing, deepen the reforms, do things like the completion of the single market, and actually get the fundamentals right. Or it could expand into new areas and expand geographically. And it's tried to do both those things simultaneously. It's tried to expand its remit and its borders, while at the same time try to deepen the reforms and which were already in place. And it's as a result, it seems to have failed on both counts. It's not really finished completing those fundamental reforms that were necessary to actually get the economy working properly, and nor has it actually managed to actually find a role for itself in the wider world, partly because its economics has actually been a bit awry. I just wonder whether it was...
I think that the expansion of the borders of the EU to include Central and Eastern Europe was extremely good. I think it was extremely good for peace because it brought, you know, a huge swathe of countries that had been behind the Iron Curtain into a sort of prosperity and democracy. And I think it's also good for our economy. I know that people complain about immigration from Eastern Europe, but all the evidence shows that the people who come here from Eastern Europe are hardworking, they're young, we haven't paid for their education, they pay their taxes, they're not living off benefit, etc. So I think on that side, I'm completely in favor of the expansion. I think that the deepening, particularly the single currency, well, I mean, it's obvious that was a disaster. But they are cleaning it up, and it's not going to go away, the single currency. It was extremely premature, but they've got it, and they've got to make the best of a bad job.
Do you think in the end, as some of the founders of the single currency sort of half-secretly wanted, it's going to force political integration that wouldn't have happened without it?
I actually don't buy that argument. I know that was the wish of many of the founders of single currency, and it's also the view of many Eurosceptics in Britain that you can't have monetary union without full fiscal and political union. I think you actually can. And I think we've sort of, because the rise of Euroscepticism is not just a UK phenomenon. You're seeing it right across Europe, particularly in France. Well, France is the critical one. They don't want, I mean, I can't see Hollande agreeing to a referendum to give more powers to the EU when he's going to have to be fighting against Marine Le Pen, who's rising in the opinion polls. She did very well in the local elections only last weekend.
Mm. But some form of greater political coordination and fiscal union is going to be necessary to actually repair the euro. I can't see the euro doing anything other than stagger from crisis to crisis unless there is some way of ending this halfway house system we've got at the moment. I think you know, either the euro disintegrates or there are steps towards greater fiscal and banking harmony. Otherwise, we are going to end up in this very, very fragile state where the euro is vulnerable.
I think there's a third way, though. I know that what you said, Larry, is what almost everybody believes, but there's a third way, and I think the third way is a more competitive economy. And that's what's actually happening, is that it's very painful. The Greeks, for example, have been forced through years of recession, terrible recession, partly their own fault, partly because of mistakes by the European Union and the IMF. But they have actually started reforming their economy.
But when you say more competitive, isn't one of the problems that some of that competition is tax competition, race to the bottom on who can have the lowest corporation tax, which is not a productive way to go? Doesn't Europe have to say, sorry, we're having a floor under corporation tax, we're not going to have this cheating by Ireland and other countries? That's false competition, not fair competition.
I think you certainly need to have some coordination. I'm not convinced we need to have a floor under corporation tax. What I do think, and what we're actually already seeing, Polly, is we're seeing more coordination, not just inside the EU, but at the G7 and the G20 level, G8, I don't know if it exists anymore, on stopping multinationals shifting profit around from one country to tax havens in order to avoid paying tax. And you're also seeing, not just against multinationals, but also a crackdown against tax abuse by individuals and avoiding paying their fair share. I think that in terms of tax, I think that actually to make Europe competitive, it's important particularly not to tax jobs too highly. So I think that's very important. We don't tax jobs too highly. That means not too high social contributions, not too high income tax. Corporation tax, I'm not too fussed about.
Finally on this, Hugo, Nigel Farage, I thought, was easily at his strongest last night when he was making the case, not for or against Europe, but just for giving the people a say. You talk about a third way there of yes, it's painful, but we can have deflation, more increased competitiveness. Isn't the problem that Europe,
deflation, more competitiveness.
Okay, or whatever you call it, holding down wages relative to output.
Also boosting productivity. That's the other way you improve your competitiveness.
But are the voters are against this, aren't they? That's in the end is why this club of democracies has become undemocratic.
I think that, I mean, you have to live, you basically do ultimately have to live within your means, and the process of getting competitive is pretty painful. But if you look around Greece, I go to these countries a lot. I'm off to Athens on Sunday. I was in Madrid last week. Actually, despite all the pain, they all want to stay, not all, but as large majorities want to stay not just in the European Union, but in the single currency. That said, I do agree with you when you say that Farage made a very, had pretty much the debate all in his favor when he was saying that, why don't we give the people a choice now? You're just running scared. And I think that Clegg's answer, oh, if we have a referendum now, it'll be bad for the economy, was pretty weak. I think you need to have a better argument for that. And I think there are better arguments.
There certainly are. You just have to say, I'm sorry, but as leader of the Labour Party, for instance, I so profoundly believe that it would be a disaster for the country to leave that I will not have a referendum. If you want to vote for a referendum, if you want to vote for out, there's UKIP. But if you vote for us, we're the party of in, and I'm not going to be a Prime Minister responsible for taking us out. And I think if you make that strong stand, you say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to give people an option to do something I think so damaging. At this election, you have a very clear choice. It's very democratic. Vote UKIP if that's what you want.
Well, nothing's more certain than the fact that this one is going to run. You can find out plenty more on the run-up to EU's parliamentary elections in May at theguardian.com/politics. Now, this week, a scathing report on the sale of Royal Mail put the cost to the taxpayer in lost revenue at £750 million on a single day. The share offering, overseen by Vince Cable, was defended by the business secretary as a success. Rather than seeing it as money lost, we should see it, he said, as a loss-making public enterprise that has been offloaded and revitalised. So, Larry, who's right?
Well, I think Vince is making the best of a bad job. I suppose the best case that you can make for Vince and the government is that it's the first major privatisation for quite a long time and that they didn't really know what the right price was, so they pitched it at a level where they knew they would get the issue away. I think that argument just really won't wash, though. I mean, if you really wanted to take an example of how very little has changed in Britain in the last 5 years, the sell-off of Royal Mail surely exemplifies it. So it was an issue where there was a massive conflict of interest. The government was being advised by people who were going to make a killing out of it. It was grotesquely underpriced. And you know, if Labour cannot make political capital out of this, then it really deserves shooting, really, because it's sort of, you know, here we are, you know, the party of posh boys giving away a public asset at a knockdown price to its mates. I mean, that seems to me to be where this is all about politically, and I think it has been undervalued. I mean, it was undervalued partly because the government took advice from people who are going to be making money out of it.
Wasn't there some detail that some of these people who are going to be making money out of it had promised to hold on to these shares for 3 years or something, and then we just
didn't even hold on for 3 weeks? It was. I think they just pulled the wool over Vince's eyes. I mean, you know, Vince, bless him, he said some very, very strong things about the financial sector in the city when he was in opposition, and most of them turned out to be right. On this occasion, I think he was just led right up the garden path.
Larry, couldn't they have sealed those bids and said, if you take these shares, these 16 institutional investors, you have to hold them for 3 years. We're looking for long-term investors. Was there no way in making sure they didn't just make a quick killing and sold it all off? Now the next majority shareholder is actually
I'm not sure you could do that. But if you want to actually ensure that no one makes a killing, you should have kept it in the public sector. That was would have kept the shares in the hands of the government. But I'm not sure you can actually say to an investor, if you buy this share and it goes up, you're locked into holding it for 3 years. I think I think you can.
I think you can. It's a private contract. If they would have had to agree to it, but the counter argument would have said, well, if you want us to hold it for 3 years, we need an even lower price. But I do think Vince made a mistake. That's clear. I think these things are difficult because it wasn't just that they were worried about selling it and then the price, you know, falling on the day. But if it had fallen, say it had fallen after a few months and then a lot of retail investors come in, everyone would have been criticizing, oh, you sold it to expensive and poor retail investors, the government, blah, blah, blah. But there were ways that they could have done it. And what I think they should have done is they should have sold a smaller amount off at the start, sold it only to institutional investors, a small amount, get it at a higher price, and then wait and see where it settled in the market, and then open it up to the retail investors.
And why didn't they do that? Did they want the kind of Telsid 1980s-style moment?
I don't know. I think that it's all driven by the political timescale of wanting to get most of it out, or, you know, to basically make sure it was fully and utterly privatized before the general election. I suppose that was the sort of thinking.
I think you have to remember how much these are Thatcher's boys who had her poster on their wall, and they think they remember they were kids, the glory days of the Telsid moment, and they thought they could relive it, recapture that first.
Vince Cable wasn't one of Thatcher's kids.
And this wasn't the Telsid offer either, was it?
He should have leaned against that view.
Of course, he should have done, but he's always caved in every time. He makes a fine stand and then he buckles.
This wasn't a big public offering either, was it? It wasn't a Telsid type thing, because this was one aimed primarily at institutions rather than, I mean...
I think it should have been a smaller tranche only at institutions at a higher price. Then you wouldn't have... If they sold it at, you know, a high price and then it had fallen, nobody would have minded, because it would have been the city that have lost. It was only because I know it wasn't fully aimed at the retail investor, but the retail investor was there.
I have to say, a while ago, I worked in the Department of Trade and Industry, and I remember that one of the excuses, and the officials there, some of them on secondment from the city, were always trying to push the privatisation of Royal Mail. But one of the arguments you always ran into, if you suggested doing anything different, was that European law wouldn't allow it, state aid rules. Don't you think, Hugo, this is the kind of thing that can give Europe a bad name, in that ministers might come in and want to do something radical with some service or some state-owned industry, and then they're told it gets stopped because of European law that no one's quite sure how to change?
I must say I'm not aware of any European law that would have prevented them selling a small tranche focused on institutional investors.
No, but maintaining it as a public service and pouring in public funds to invest in it.
Oh, yes. Well, certainly if they were giving state aid, that would be that would get them into difficult territory with the European Union. Frankly, I'm not in favour of state aid, so I don't have a problem with that. I think it's important not only that we don't subsidise our industries, but that other countries inside the European Union don't subsidise their industries, because otherwise you don't have a level playing field. And the problem then is that subsidised inefficient industries can end up beating more efficient industries in the market just because they've got the government standing behind them.
Does everybody stick to those rules, or do we stick to them more strictly than they do?
We are better, but frankly, one of the good things about the European Commission is that it is actually tough enough to really bear down on state aid and anti-competitive practices. I mean, just look at what they've done with, you know, Google and Microsoft. I mean, they stand at the idea. I mean, just to come back to the first point, the idea that Britain on its own would have the guts to fight Google and Microsoft, I think is just for the birds. I think that we want to back a strong commission in terms of enforcement and in policing the rules. That doesn't mean that we want more powers to go there, but those powers that they have, they damn well better make sure that people abide by the rules.
One reason, Larry, why this Royal Mail sale was being closely watched is because there's other sales in prospect, aren't there, with RBS and HBOS and so on. Do you think those are going to be held back if this becomes a bad news story?
I think the government would be desperately like to get them away before the election. I think what we'd probably do is let the dust settle for a bit, see whether this row does, you know, gather momentum. If it doesn't, I think we can expect to see more sales of RBS and Lloyds Banking Group before the election. I don't think this in itself will stop them from selling off. It will depend, I think, on market conditions, and B, it will depend on the political climate. But I don't think it necessarily will rule it out, no.
Quite a lot of other things too. After all, land registry coming along, canals and waterways. Extraordinary that even English Heritage has been privatised. English Heritage has been privatised. A lot of privatisation has been going on in ways that people haven't quite clocked. But, you know, maybe there'll be resistance over land registry.
Margaret Thatcher, Polly, famously hesitated at the idea of selling off Royal Mail because it was royal and so it couldn't be done. But you're talking there about English Heritage and things a long way from the banks. Is there still any appetite, any concept even of public enterprise as distinct from treating something like Royal Mail as just another company?
Well, I find it fascinating that there really is amongst the people that when it comes to rail nationalisation, if anything sounds more old Labour, it's bring back rail, you get Tory voters in favour of restoring rail. We're spending more in rail subsidy than we did before when it was nationalised. You have very angry commuters wondering why such large chunks of the huge sums they spend go straight into private pockets. So I think there's quite a sense that the state owning things is not all bad.
Times are changing on that, Larry?
Yeah, I think it's interesting politically that on some issues the electorate has moved to the right in the last 5 years on things like immigration and on welfare, and on some issues like nationalisation of the railways and bankers' bonuses and so on, it's moved to the left. That's what makes the current political backdrop to the run up to elections so interesting, that no one can really actually say where the electorate is going to go, because there's been a bifurcation. I think it's no longer people sort of sitting in the middle where they broadly agree about everything. On some issues they've definitely become more radical. On some issues they've become more conservative, and that's a fascinating backdrop, I think.
Yeah, so plenty of interesting things for us to talk about in coming weeks. My thanks then to Polly Toynbee, to Larry Elliott, and also to Hugo Dixon, whose book The In-Out Question is available through Amazon now. There's no programme next week, so we're back in a fortnight. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.